The Arctic is a vast, cold, forbidding, clean white slate full of potential, a playground for the imagination. From whale oil to furs, gold, petroleum, and minerals, the Arctic has held the promise of abundant wealth for those who could stand the cold. And explorers, dictators, and prospectors, now climate change, have all transformed the region throughout the centuries. Charles Emmerson was drawn to those blank white spaces at the top of the map as a child. After serving as a geopolitical expert with the World Economic Forum's Global Risk Network, he left to travel the Arctic and find out whether his childhood ideas were true. His book, The Future History of the Arctic, is published by Public Affairs, and I'm pleased that it brings Charles Emmerson to our show today. Hello.
Hello, good morning.
Did your background in geopolitics play a role in your decision to write about a future history of the Arctic?
Absolutely. Well, I found myself, a lot of my work at the World Economic Forum was about the intersection of, say, geopolitical risk with energy security, with climate change. And the Arctic seemed a place where you could really actually see all those tectonic forces really colliding. I think you could say it did.
You say the Arctic captured your imagination from an early age. How did you become acquainted with it, and what fascinated you about it, rather than any of a number of other fascinating parts of the globe?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I do talk in the book a bit about my fascination with maps, and you mentioned this map that I had in my...
But it could be the Amazon, could be Africa, could be the American Southwest, or...
Yeah, I think the real answer is that there was the map element to it, and as you said, the Arctic is a place where your imagination can sort of roam free, if you like, and we do tend to project our image onto the Arctic. But the other thing about it was that it was actually the politics of it. Even from quite a young age, I was fascinated by the idea that this was a place where Soviet citizens could coexist with Norwegians or with Canadians or with U.S. citizens.
And when you finally went there, did it turn out to be similar to what you'd imagined?
No. I was kind of disappointed. I was about 10 years old. I was in Sweden with my mother. She wanted to stay in Stockholm and sort of go to the art galleries. I wanted to go to Kiruna, which is a place where they mine iron ore. And for some crazy reason, my mother agreed to go. And so we went up to this place, and it doesn't look that much different from many other places, you know, from places where you mine iron ore, right? So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't. There weren't any polar bears up there.
So how do we even define the Arctic? Is it a circle on the top of the globe?
Well, there are lots of different ways of doing it. I mean, I think the classical way is to say everything above the Arctic Circle is the Arctic. But if you speak to Canadians, they'll say, well, we consider the Arctic to be above 60 degrees north, same in Russia. And of course, you can also define it in other ways. You could define it in terms of isotherms, of temperature, for example. But one of the points of writing the book is to say, well, it doesn't really matter how you define the borders of the Arctic, because the issues of the Arctic stretch far outside it. Climate change obviously being one, but also the interests of, for example, the United States in the Arctic, or the interests of China in the Arctic.
Well, Antarctica, the continent at the bottom of the globe, has been internationalized, but not the Arctic?
Yeah, well, the Antarctic Treaty is really the product of this odd moment in world history where you've got the Soviet Union on one side, the United States on the other. Neither of them has got a claim or a stake in the Antarctic. And so, of course, why not internationalize it?
Mm-hmm. Because only African and South American countries, maybe Australia, could make a claim.
Exactly. Australia, New Zealand, and the Latin American countries mostly. But, of course, the Arctic's very different because countries already have a claim there, including, of course, Russia, and, of course, including the United States with Alaska.
You say there's always been climate change in the Arctic. How much since the last ice age?
Gosh. I think the reason I talk about climate change in that sense is because I think that it's important to distinguish between man-made climate change and natural variability. And if you don't admit that there is natural variability, then people will use that against you and say, oh, well, you know, maybe what's happening now is natural variability. My point is that natural variability is there over very, very long extended periods of time. There was a time before when the Arctic was much warmer than it is now. But that doesn't mean that we can't observe the human impact now.
Well, how do you answer people like our Senator James Imhoff, who claim that what we're seeing now is not anything extraordinary? Anyone who has seen An Inconvenient Truth knows that has seen certain evidence of of ice crumbling and falling into the water.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a difficult one. The fact, of course, that ice crumbles off glaciers and falls into the sea does not in itself mean that that climate change is real. But if you look at, for example, the coverage of the Arctic Ocean over a period of 20, 30 years, of course it freezes up in winter, but it freezes up less than it used to. And you have observable results from all across the Arctic which show that it's happening.
The permafrost has been affected.
The permafrost has indeed been affected.
Can you explain the permafrost?
Yeah, the permafrost is basically, if you imagine the first few feet, sometimes up to 10, 20, even 200 feet of the Earth is literally, it's frozen solid. And that's beginning to change. It'll take a long, long, long time for the permafrost to melt. But there's an awful lot of it, and there's a lot of methane trapped in the permafrost. And as that is released, there is a risk that will contribute to, that will accelerate and affect climate change.
How have the people of the Arctic adapted to this climate change over the years?
Well, it's different in different places. I mean, there are some communities which are very obviously and very clearly affected by climate change. So, for example, if you're a whaling community in Barrow, in the north of Alaska, the northernmost community in the United States, for them, climate change means that their traditional ways of hunting become far, far more difficult. The ice is far more dangerous. It breaks up far more easily than it would have a few years ago. But for other communities, climate change is actually not such a bad thing. They may even view it as a positive thing.
Have they been seeing a lot more of people from the rest of the world recently? I remember many years ago speaking to Barry Lopez, who had written about the Arctic, and he said that one of the Inuit said to him, one day newspaper report, one week magazine article, one month book.
Yeah.
And he laughed, but it was obviously true for most people who went up there. Now, a lot more attention is being paid.
I think so, and on many different levels. I mean, of course, there's political attention being paid to it, but also there are many more tourists going up there than would have been the case 20 or 30 years ago. The region is becoming more accessible, and it's a sort of last chance to see for some people, I think.
Is tourism speeding up the cycle?
I think tourism's contribution to climate change in the Arctic is pretty minor, mm-hmm. but there are certainly questions around ecotourism. Is it good that people are seeing the Arctic and then that raises awareness about environmental issues in the Arctic and other issues in the Arctic, or is it bad because of course that contributes in some way to environmental risks there?
My guest is Charles Emerson, Emerson. His book, The Future History of the Arctic, is published by Public Affairs. And you say it's important for climate scientists to engage with politicians. Haven't they been doing that recently? Sometimes to disastrous ends?
Well, it's a really difficult one here. I was really fascinated. It's not the subject of the book, but I was fascinated by talking to scientists in the Arctic and understanding this really tough choice they face. Science is about hypotheses. Science is about uncertainty. When it comes to climate change, however, politicians, the public, they want certainty. They want scientists to say, this is going to happen on this day, and the world is going to hit up by this many degrees, and you need to do this and that. And scientists are faced with the choice, well, look, do I simplify my research in order to make a political point? But then, of course, I may be caught out. Or do I just say, okay, no, I'm a scientist. It's not my job to do that.
And many scientists are actually kind of taught to stay out of politics, no matter what their personal politics are.
Yeah, absolutely. But at the same time, there's such a demand. I think we're a pretty scientifically illiterate, stage in human history. But we sort of demand scientific advice. We demand expert advice.
Although if it isn't always what we want to read, then we wind up with scandals like what they're calling Climate Gate.
Yeah, this is the University of East Anglia email scandal. Yeah, that's I think that the fact that there are a few scientists who overstep the mark should not distract from the vast wealth of evidence.
Why are countries without Arctic borders like China and India doing Arctic research? I understand the United States, Canada, Russia, Norway, Sweden, Finland, etc. Yeah. Greenland, Iceland, I assume?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you've got the A5, who are the coastal states in the Arctic. Then you've got other states that don't have any sort of frontage to the Arctic Ocean, Finland, Sweden. But then you've got, for example, China, which has research scientists up in the Arctic, India. Their interests are really twofold. One is to do with climate change, because Arctic science really is the cutting edge of climate science. They want to understand what's going on because it impacts them back home. Back in India, back in China. But also there's a broader and, I think, fascinating strategic question. I was actually in Shanghai just a few days ago, and the discussion there around the importance of the Arctic from a strategic point of view is really slowly rising up the agenda. Because if the Arctic becomes a free, relatively navigable ocean, there's a question of, well, who's going to control it, A, but B, what ships are going to use it, what resources will be transported across the Arctic.
We're talking about the creation of a real Northwest Passage that so many explorers imagine they would find when they first cross the Atlantic to the Americas.
Yeah, there's this tremendous fascination with the Northwest Passage, of course.
And that would change everything, wouldn't it? It would make the Suez Canal, the Panama Canal, perhaps less important.
Well, but funnily enough, I sort of think the Northwest Passage isn't where the money is here. I think the money really is in the Northeast Passage. That's to say, going across the north coast of Russia. That's because the Russians actually want that shipping, whereas the Canadians are far more they're far less sure that they actually want to have ships going through the Northwest Passage. And then, of course, further out in maybe 20 or 30 years from now, then you're talking about a transpolar route, so really across the pole.
Would it be different? Well, transpolar would be kind of frightening, wouldn't it? It would mean that the ice cap would have developed total fissures and you could go right through it?
Yeah, I mean, people talk about an ice-free
Arctic.
Would
that be positive?
It depends who you talk to. I mean, if you imagine you're in Reykjavik, Iceland, your economy has just melted down entirely.
I can't imagine something like that happening.
but now they say, well, you know, how are we going to survive now that the banks have collapsed? What are we going to do? Well, one thing we might do is we might build a massive transshipment port. We'll be a sort of Arctic Singapore. That's not going to happen tomorrow, but in 20 years' time, who knows?
Well, would these northern routes help dull the impact of rising energy prices? Because they'd cut down on the cost of international shipping, wouldn't they?
They would, but I think it's key to come back to this central point about the Arctic ice, which is that when we talk about an ice-free Arctic, we're talking about sometime in summer. The Arctic will always freeze up in winter, and when it freezes up and where it freezes up will change from year to year. So I think the Arctic being used as a sort of as a transport route for pretty low-value cargoes is a fairly long way off. It's much more likely in the nearer term that it's used for oil and gas.
Would the countries involved, you mentioned Russia liking this idea, would they hope to control it the way Egypt controls the Suez Canal or Panama controls the Panama Canal? Or who controls the Panama Canal now? I guess it's still the U.S.
Well, no, I think it's still – well, I think it's Panama.
Yeah.
I mean, I think clearly the Russians would want to control the Northeast Passage. They'd have every right to, because that would be in
be going through their waters.
Absolutely. But I think they have an interest in doing that.
And right now, aren't there a lot of people up there trying to decide where the continental shelf ends, so that various countries can make claim to a lot of an area that once was just covered by ice?
That's right. There are a lot of issues around the ownership of the seabed, the extended continental shelf, and there are a large number of scientific missions up there to basically gather evidence, geological evidence, so they can understand, so they can fulfill various conditions which need to be fulfilled in order to make a claim. But there will always be overlapping claims, and that's where the diplomats come in, because there's going to be there's going to have to be discussions between the Arctic states about exactly who owns what.
My guest is Charles Emmison, who's been a Global Leadership Fellow and Associate Director of the World Economic Forum, heading the World Economic Forum's Global Risk Network. He's written a book called The Future History of the Arctic, which is published by Public Affairs. And we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Charles Emerson, E-M-M-E-R-S-O-N, his book, The Future History of the Arctic, published by Public Affairs. Your descriptions of how the Arctic has been developed and how that development could be destroying biological diversity and the opportunities to discover useful plants and organisms reminds me of what's been happening in the rainforests of South America and Asia. Is there a similarity in your mind?
Absolutely. I think they're a perfect analog, or nearly perfect analog. One of the things I was trying to do with the book is try and challenge some of the ideas we have about the way we think about the Arctic. We tend to think about the Arctic in terms of aesthetics. We tend to think about biodiversity in terms of something which is sort of as if it was just nice to have. And the point that I'm trying to make is that it's not just nice to have, it's vital to have.
But how much plant life is up there?
Well, it's not so much necessarily about plant life so much as processes. So, for example, there are enzymes which exist in Arctic organisms, which can be incredibly useful. They can have, for example, medical applications or commercial applications far further south. And this is a very rich source of material which we haven't really yet fully explored.
Do we have any idea of how much mineral wealth is in the Arctic?
Well, the USGS came up with, the United States Geological Survey came up with a figure of 90 billion barrels of oil in the Arctic, of undiscovered.
And I'm assuming gas is also up there, natural gas.
Yes, and actually there's actually much more natural gas, probably, than there is oil. So there's a lot of it out there.
Does all of that oil push back the peak oil calculations?
Well, the issue here really is there's quite a lot of oil left in the world. The question is how much it costs to produce. And Arctic oil and gas is quite hard to get at. It's quite expensive to produce. It's now becoming profitable to produce because, of course, the price of oil it's lower than it was a year and a half ago, but it's pretty much at a historic high.
Well, Russia has pretty much depended on its oil and gas resources to drive its economy. Is it the country that is most hopeful for serious exploration?
I think if you imagine your President Medvedev sitting in Moscow and you see your oil and gas fields declining in Western Siberia, and you know that your position in the Kremlin really depends on oil, and your position vis-a-vis your European partners depends on your ability to provide them with natural gas. And then there are these resources up in the Arctic. Are you going to develop them or not? Of course you are. It's a strategic imperative for Russia.
Well, Russia is the largest producer of oil. It was at any way in 2008, I assume, last year as well.
Yeah.
How well is it managing its resources?
Well, Russia has a few problems here. It's got a very old infrastructure. It's got a model for production inherited from the Soviet Union, which was really much more about getting as much out as you can very quickly and not caring very much about the environmental consequences. So there are questions about how successful the Russians will be in quite difficult places like the Arctic.
Well, you say that for Russians, thinking of the Arctic as a white desert is an affront to ingenuity and a failure of imagination. So what role does the Arctic play in the Russian psyche?
Well, I visited a fascinating place called the Solovetsky Monastery, which is it's in the White Sea, so it's actually just below the Arctic Circle. A place which was a monastery, a source of spiritual refuge. Also, it was used as a prison camp.
Joseph Stalin was sent to prison in the Arctic, wasn't he?
He was indeed. He was up there between 1913 and 1917 in a place called Turikansk. And he developed this wonderful mythology of himself as a sort of Arctic hunter and explorer. And then, of course, when he was Soviet dictator, he really challenged the idea of the Arctic as an empty place and said, no, we're going to develop it, and never mind the environmental or indeed human cost.
What role did the Arctic play during the Cold War, other than for submarines to go underneath the ice sheet?
Well, that was a very, very important role. In the book I cover this sort of ebb and flow of strategic importance of the Arctic depending on the technologies which were being used at the time, whether it was bombers or nuclear submarines. But of course, the simple geographical fact was, and is, that the shortest distance between Russia and the United States is across the Arctic.
Mm-hmm. In 2007, a Russian explorer planted a Russian flag on the seabed at the North Pole. What was the reaction from the international community There was a certain amount of outrage, wasn't there?
There was. Some of it, I think, may have been a little bit simulated. But, I mean, the Canadian foreign minister said, you know, this isn't the 14th or 15th century. You can't just go around planting flags somewhere and saying it's your own.
You have to give it its independence, ultimately, if you do that.
That's the history of the British Empire, isn't it? Of course, the independence of the North Pole. That's the idea for my next book, then.
Well, we'll talk about Greenland in a little bit.
Of course, but I mean, I think the Russian foreign minister came back and said, well, look, you know, the Americans have put their flag on the moon. Does that make the moon American? So this wasn't really so much a legal claim as evidence of Russia's capacity to get around in the Arctic, which most countries don't have.
But it was obviously something symbolic to the Russians.
Absolutely. And exactly. It's something of great symbolic importance. It's the way of the Russians saying, look, this isn't a sort of legal claim of ownership, but we're showing that we can do what you can't. And we're also showing that we consider this to be our backyard.
And isn't this something that's going to be discussed before the next G8?
I'm not sure if it's on the agenda of the next G8, but it's certainly.
I understand there'll be an Arctic Nations Summit. Prior to
I see. Well, there's a meeting of the Arctic coastal states, which is happening later this month in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Everybody invited?
No, not at all. And this is an interesting point about Arctic governance. Who do you bring into the tent? And who do you leave outside? So for this particular discussion in Canada, it's the Arctic coastal states, not including, for example, Iceland, or Sweden, or Finland. And then there are other fora where bigger groups of states get together.
And Sweden and Iceland and Finland are not considered Arctic coastal states?
Well, they're not because Sweden and Finland are sort of closed in on the north mm-hmm. by Russia on one side and Norway on the other. And as for Iceland, well, Iceland's just below the Arctic Circle. It's definitely an Arctic nation. I think it probably should be in these discussions. But, Iceland's pretty hard up these days.
And what about Greenland, which is a semi-autonomous part of Denmark with a strong independence movement? What are the benefits and risks for an independent Greenland?
Well, the Greenlanders are in this interesting position. They most of the population of Greenland is indigenous. The island, which is the same size pretty much as Western Europe, has been dependent on the Danes economically for a long time now. They get about $10,000 a year per head from the Danish government in Copenhagen. And they look at, some of them look at climate change, they look at oil and gas development in the Arctic, and they say, great, this is an opportunity. This is our way of becoming economically self-sustaining and therefore allowing us to be independent.
And what about Denmark? Is it what does it gain or lose if Greenland were to become independent?
Well, I mean, the Danes don't really have that much choice. If oil and gas fields are developed off Greenland, and if the Greenlanders want to be independent, then that's going to happen. But the one part of the self-rule agreement, which came into force in 2009, last summer, was a sharing for some time of income from resource development on Greenland. So the Danes do have something to gain from Greenland's economic development as well.
Now, drilling in the Arctic in Alaska is a big political hot potato in this country. Beyond the despoiling of the environment, aren't there all sorts of other matters you mentioned? It's rather expensive to extract the oil and then to ship it from this very northern climate.
It is, but then of course the price of oil is very high at the moment. It's lower than it was a year and a half ago, but it's historically very high, and that actually makes it economically viable. There's a big question now about gas, of course, because there's been all these finds of unconventional gas in North America, so there's a question whether that affects the economics of producing Arctic gas.
Well, how much of its oil and gas does the U.S. get from Alaska? I've heard that we ship that there isn't all that much oil up there, but we ship much of it to Asia and don't even use it for ourselves.
Well, the question about Arctic oil and gas, Alaskan Arctic oil and gas, in my mind, it gets really exploded in the American political context. There's a great tendency to view Alaska as being, America's prime source of oil and gas now and in the future. The numbers don't really stack up. In my mind, the development of Alaskan oil and gas in the future, I can see some I can see why the Alaskans are clearly very interested in that, but it's not as if America's energy security depends upon the production of Arctic oil and gas.
When the U.S. bought Alaska from Russia in the 1860s, what did we think that we were getting? It was called Seward's Folly, and it was considered a big mistake at the time, wasn't it?
I think the truth is that it wasn't really known. I mean, Seward's one of these fascinating characters who's been rather airbrushed from American history. I mean, everyone, of course, knows Lincoln, but what they maybe don't know is that Seward was actually a real contender to be the Republican presidential candidate in place of Lincoln, and indeed Seward and Lincoln formed quite a team. But the truth is that they had there was really very little idea of what was being bought when Alaska became American.
Other than a huge landmass that brought us close to Asia,
absolutely, there was sort of that strategic idea, I think, in the back of Seward's mind, and there was this idea that there would of course be mineral resources and other resources there, but this was not really known. This was more a hypothesis.
Who was Vilhjálmur Stefánsson, and how did he influence U.S. and Canadian understanding of an engagement in the Arctic? Is it Vilja or Vilhjálmur?
Vilhjálmur Stefánsson, who's this rather wonderful character from the beginning of the 20th century, who had great ideas about the Arctic being a seat of a future empire, a seat of future power, and for various reasons, through various misadventures, his good work for the Canadians in the north. Nonetheless, eventually led him to leaving Canada and settling in the United States, where he advised the U.S. government on military affairs in the north.
Well, Alaska allowed Sarah Palin to develop a foreign policy, didn't she? She could look across the Bering Straits. But the U.S. did become really interested in the north with Admiral Peary, didn't it?
Absolutely. Although, again, this is an interesting story. There are people like Stefánsson and people like Peary who had a vision in the early 20th century of the Arctic as being of great strategic importance. But they didn't necessarily find very much of an echo with the governments at the time. There's this great story of Peary when he actually got to the North Pole, or actually when he got back to Labrador, and telegraphing the president saying, "I've got the North Pole, it's at your disposal. You know, the North Pole's American." And President Taft saying, "Well, thanks, but what am I supposed to do with it?" And I think that there were some visionaries, if you like, who had an idea of the Arctic strategic importance. But it's only much more recently that that's become much more widely accepted.
So we've talked about the Arctic with the ice breaking up, a northeast and a northwest passage. We've talked about oil and gas reserves becoming available to us. I understand there's some gold up there as well.
Yeah.
Those are all positives. What are the negatives of all of this?
Well, I mean, I think the negatives, first of all, for some of the people living there, is that their life ways are being torn apart. And I think there's also
Is there a danger to the planet, as some people have suggested?
Well, the danger to the planet really comes from climate change more than it comes from, in my view, rather than coming from oil and gas development. But of course, there will be greater pollution as a result of oil and gas development. If it's badly managed, there's a much higher risk of pollution up in the Arctic. And I think that there's a broader question as to what humans owe to the planet, what humans owe to the Arctic.
And if the ice melts, we're told there'll be flooding along the coastlines of most low-lying areas.
Absolutely, but this is not the Arctic ice cap is floating on the Arctic Ocean, right? So when that melts, that doesn't actually affect the sea levels. What does affect sea levels is if the ice, which is on Greenland, up to 2 miles thick at the middle. Now, when that begins to melt and begins to come into the oceans, then that causes quite serious sea level rise.
Won't trees in the area benefit from warmer climate?
Some trees may benefit, but then if the climate becomes much warmer, there also may be water stress there as well. So it's in some places maybe, but there are no massive countervailing forces here.
And that is the reason that we can't seem to come up with any agreement?
any agreement about
what how we should proceed.
Well, I think there's this idea that we could come up with some kind of global agreement about how the Arctic is developed. And my view is that the interests are just too disparate in order to do that.
Charles Emerson's book is called The Future History of the Arctic. It is published by Public Affairs. By the way, Mr. Emerson spells his name for some reason with two M's, E-M-M-E-R-S-O-N. I've never seen it spelled that way.
I think that's a relative in Yorkshire some time ago who wanted to be different.
And I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a fascinating discussion.
Thank you.
This is WNYC, WNYC.org.